that was the calibration of the finding the porosity value and the permeability value. It was very helpful, and we won the case. And from there, I went on to finding the deliverability and so on, the reserves of two other pipeline cases. One was the American Louisiana, going from Detroit to Louisiana. The other one was the West Coast case from British Columbia and Alberta into the West Coast. It was called the West Coast case.
Did you do anything on the Alaskan pipeline?
Yes. On the oil line, I reviewed a bit of this question for a consulting firm in New York. It was, if the line stopped for, say, a period of time, like 3 weeks in the wintertime when it was minus 40, how long would the oil congeal so much that it couldn't be started? The pour point on that line of that oil is 34 degrees. And we made calculations and looked like that in 3 weeks they would still have some movable oil in the middle of the pipette. It was a 48-inch diameter. I've been there to see the Prudhoe Bay before the line was built, before the field was developed fully, but just, you know, 15, 20 wells had been drilled. On the proposed gas line, I was the process design consultant. In the pipelines, the man from Detroit, the chief engineer of Detroit American Natural System, said to me one day, in about mid-December, he said, "Why don't you build a liquefied natural gas, an LNG line?" And I said, "Oh, that's too cold," and I let it go, and I went home, and I sat down and made what I call the dense phase line. A dense phase is, well, put it this way. A natural gas pipeline is, say, 6 or 7 or 8 pounds per cubic foot, a normal line at 1,000 pounds. Liquefied natural gas at minus 250 Fahrenheit is 27 pounds per cubic foot. I said, well, make it about a 19-pound and be just below the critical of methane, close to it, minus 120, and keep the pressure always up at 500 or 600 pounds. Never let it drop below that. Well, you can carry it through. And I made a hand calculation design for the line. And then, of course, instead of using a 48, I could use a 36-inch pipe, same flow. And the questions came up of things like nickel steel versus ordinary steel. The other question that came up was the state regulations are not available to the extent you had that kind of a thing down here. Of course, you'd only take it through permafrost, I believe, a dense phase line. But this concept is still being looked at. My son was with ARCO. He's taken an early retirement because the whole group of technical people he was involved with were sort of let go when they had this consolidation last summer and last fall. And so but they were looking at it and bringing it to Cook's Inlet for Japan. They're going to take the gas from Prudhoe to Cook's Inlet, which can be made a year-round shipping. They will, whatever you might consider, a dense-phase pipeline. I also got into another area of that kind. This is a little beside it, but similar type of thing. Columbia Gas was trying to sell ESSO, an ocean shipment process. They wanted ESSO to sign a secrecy agreement, and they wouldn't. Finally, they came between them and said, "We'll hire someone to look at what you know and what we know, and if what Columbia had was different from what ESSO knew, why, they'd sign a secrecy agreement." And I was selected. I was in both hats, and I selected, and I did it. It wasn't a very hard job, just to interview both companies and see them. But it was this dense phase. They were going to build a high-pressure ship, tubes, and fill them with this high-dense phase, and they would not liquefy it. They only cool it to minus 90, save a lot of refrigeration. The only trouble was they had no refrigeration aboard, and they could not have the boil-off. It was only for a short haul across the Mediterranean, really. And so ESSO finally said they couldn't buy it, but they had spent a lot of money, Columbia had. And I could show them a movie, what it looked like in their dense phase, because that's what this critical stuff was we did. So I was involved in the gas line and never got built, as you know. Actually, the Federal Power Commission said, well, only one applicant, there must be two, or if it isn't a good project. And, of course, the second one came in and through some environmental bit, why they got the bid. They changed it from being the best hauler of gas to going along the oil pipeline and the Alaskan Highway, regardless of the fact you didn't really want to go that way, but the environmental people won, you see. So it's not been built. But we did do a dense phase, an LNG, and a chilled conventional. The people on the Alaskan line, for what I worked with, the Williams brothers people, they used a chilled conventional where they got 12 pounds per cubic foot gas. See, 12 pounds between the 6 or 7 and the 19 or 27. But you had to put tires on it because you'd have a long distance ductal fracture if it hyperfractured.
I have a list of other things that you have been involved with, and these are not in any particular order, but the first one you had mentioned earlier, and that was that trip to Brazil, South America. Were you on a sabbatical when you did that?
No, I just took time off for a semester. I had given up the chairmanship, you see, the previous year, and I always wanted to do something of this kind, to be away, and so I took a job of teaching one semester in Rio in the first half of 1963 to start a full daytime teaching program where the students were there during the day and studied during the day. They weren't off doing something else. It was not a part-time. And they had only 9 students, their master's level, but they were all subsidized. They were people who were instructors elsewhere or their own. And they went through this program. I taught thermodynamics and heat transfer. I tried to look at source of textbooks for the National Research Council, people like that, the library system. If you wanted to get the ASME transactions, you had to call San Jose dos Campos at the School for the Military there and have it sent to Rio. They didn't even have a copy in Rio, although they had an engineering school, a mechanical engineering, you see. So that I tried it, and it did, and it's taken. I had a visitor last week who teaches there now, who came. He's trying to start a laboratory of phase behavior, and especially of gas hydrates, which I'm very familiar, of course. But he came just by a kind of accident to see me and to talk about it. Invited me to come down next year if I'd come, for a short period at least. It was the time to renew my studies and get back into research, and after I'd been on the department chairman for 10 years, 11 years.
Did you use any the question I asked, I just lost it. Did you do any advising with curriculum in terms of?
Well, some, yes, I did. I went to, I visited Belo Horizonte. I visited Sao Paulo with the deans and so on. Their people were not really concentrated to do good work at the universities. They were all people with other interests. Their pay was not very good. They had to make a living as an engineer or something else. And that, of course, is a difficult problem. The pay they gave me was a high pay, and it paid my rent, period. I had a fellowship from the Organization of American States, passport, and a relationship with them. They paid me addition. But even at that, I told them, I figured it cost me $10,000 to go there for a semester.
Did that develop any longer-lasting relationships with the people there?
Well, there were several people who followed me. One from Florida, somebody from Minnesota, other places. And it is a going concern. It is the school now has 15 faculty, and they have 40 graduate students, and they're going quite strong, he says, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it did really initiate a program that they, Latin America, had not had. The University of Mexico, I visited there in 1960 in chemical engineering. They had, I think it was chemical engineering or all engineering, I don't know which, anyway. They had 210 faculty, 10 on site.
Gosh.
Something like that, you know?
We've touched on safety before and your interest in safety developing out of that unfortunate incident in the laboratory. But you've been involved in a number of other aspects of safety as well. Could you discuss that briefly?
Yes. I gave a paper for the National Academy of Engineering. That's in the references, about 1970. Safety in the petroleum industry. They were getting ready to have a meeting on that topic of safety. And I brought together the head of DuPont Safety, head of Dow Chemical Safety, the head of Sun Oil, head of Natural Gas Pipeline of America, and I guess one other person. I had them to my office for a day. And I said to them, I'm giving this paper, and the question I want to ask you is, what would you do if someone handed you $10 million and said, go improve safety for us? What would you do? Well, Sal Queener of DuPont said, well, I know. He said, we had 11 people killed in a bad accident at Louisville. It was where they were using acetylene to make this synthetic rubber. He said, I got together for each plant, the person who designed, the people who designed the plant, people who operate the plant, the safety division, the fire division, the management and its operation, and even at the level of a shift operator. And I said to them, tell me what are your problems. You tell us, you tell each other what the problems are. You keep minutes, and you find the near misses. And then you make a recommendation as what ought to be done. And then at the end of the next year, when you come back and do this again, you see what was done as compared to what you said ought to be done. He said in the next 2-3 years, we had the finest safety record we ever had. And this was part of my paper. And, of course, other people chipped in. But as you know, the petroleum industry and the others have a relatively good safety record. This would have been at that time. The five divisions of the oil business, the refinery, the chemical, the pipelines, the production, what else, but it couldn't have been. It did not include the auto accidents of the employees as such, but I don't mean in going and coming to work. I mean, but while on the job, it did. There were 75 fatalities per year at that time for that whole big industry, which, of course, was relatively low. And I tried to show that. I tried to say this. I tried to work with the American Standards Association, but they brushed it off. They didn't understand. That I read every case of the 75 fatalities to the extent there were records in the API. And a few cases were materials. Materials just failed, corroded or something. Most of them were management systems problems. Somebody didn't know this about that or something, the systems problems. And so I brought forth this systems review concept And I said there ought to be, in the Standards Association, you ought to have a model systems review for safety procedure without being specific about any plant or anything. Just have this kind of a thing that the Queener judge told us, and with an input from your committees like you're doing anything else in a standard. I said, your pipes don't rupture because you got a good safety standard. You got a boiler code. You got all these other codes. So this is what I recommended, but they never really they gave me the brush off. It was about the time they were going through the change in the name and the company organization, the group. It's, I don't even know what the name is now. It used to be ASA, American Standards Association. It's not that now. That's one of the things I was doing. The other one was 1964, the Academy of Sciences at that time and the Research Council asked me to organize and chair a committee on hazardous materials advisory to the U.S. Coast Guard. And I did it from 64 to 72. And we set up a wonderful group of people. Of course, the chemical division was in charge of the Research Council of us. And we would pick a good man, like Phillips Petroleum. We had a good organic chemist from the research department who was not involved at all in regulation. And he was a wonderful person to come and classify chemicals, tell us the safety hazard in fire and in odor and coming to your inhalation and skin in terms of auto ignition and that sort of thing, and pressure relief, we got into that, and the ability to ignite it by electrical sparks and so on. We had a team of people who really worked. We had a man from the National a code for fire codes and from the insurance companies as well as these company people. And Coast Guard people always were sitting with us. I met with the Coast Guard Admiral in charge of safety, Merchant Marine safety, you know. There was a barge sitting on a down in the middle of Cincinnati with a chlorine on it and about to turn over and that sort of thing. Yeah. Well, I was sitting there with him, and we were discussing what he should do, what advice he should give them. Of course, they had local people on the team. Hello. So I did this, and 1972, we had a meeting in 69 in Rotterdam, where we went to Rotterdam and met with the European community, and had a time there, international papers as well as our people went, and I, of course, was chairing the thing there. We had meetings.
Really, some port.
Yeah, Betty was.
You been there?
No.
Where?
Yeah, we had the harbor master in Rotterdam. It's really not a port. It's an industrial complex in which they build up land, you know, and sell it for industrial processes, particularly those involved in marine shipment.
But, Donald, it's a port. Don't mislead
me. Well, I know, but it isn't just the port.
It's fabulous.
They have
huge. It goes on and on. What he means is it goes on out to plant to land and reclaiming. You know how the Dutch do? Only you don't know how extensive that is.
They build it up, yeah. They build it up. But the important thing was that they had hazardous materials. Methods of handling. You came to the port, you have to let them know what's in your cargo, and they make you go certain rules if you've got hazardous materials. You have certain rules to follow, and certain places you have to stop to see and unload. It was that sort of a thing. And, of course, barge traffic was an important part of this, as well as ocean vessels. Got involved a little bit in the very large crude tankers. One sank, one blew up badly on the way back to Africa from England or somewhere. Honey, they did the bath, but I didn't ask them to do the bed over.
Why?
Well, I didn't see any point. Because we were going to go anyway. We decided to go. But, honey, please, now don't.
They wouldn't have minded taking
the bath. Well, honey, don't.
What?
Get this back on here. These crude tankers going back from on their empty journey would wash their tanks by hoses, and they did not wish to put inert gas into the tanks. And we finally found out this was an international project out of London, but I was in the Coast Guard. We were interested in it because of what was going on. But it turned out that when you spray water, or any spray fluid, I guess, water particularly, you can set up a spark like a rainstorm and lightning. Mm. And that this is what caused the explosion. Mobile built a new carrier, and they got the best experts in the world to help them do it right, but not with inerting. And they went out on their first trip. They blew out a deck size. The hole in the deck was as big as a football field.
My God.
So that's the kind of problem we were looking at. We had a man here at Ann Arbor who was interested in the static electricity and particles and that sort of thing. You can know that there were a lot of problems of that kind that could happen. But I was involved with trying to direct them into this, and I thought that after about 8 years that I should probably back off and let somebody else do it. And it kind of deteriorated, and finally the executive of the academy and the admiral's assistant at the Coast Guard didn't get along, and they canceled it all out. About 3 years later they asked me to come back, and I went back for a couple of years to try to start it up again.
Was that successful?
Well, I never did know. It seemed to be going along. We were looking at medical problems as well. That is, whether if a person was handling and sampled five cargoes in a given day, one of them was benzene and one of them was something else, would the interaction of the substances between the various cargoes in a human body be much more hazardous than the individual ones were? The medical team was looking at that. I forgot. Oh, we were still looking at LNG. We had this, of course, this problem on LNG I mentioned earlier was part of the solution that I did. I wrote a report for the Coast Guard on the result of this superheat limit explosion. How it would happen. I also analyzed the sulfur queen, molten sulfur queen. Sulfur queen was a ship from Houston to the Gulf Coast, to the Philadelphia area, a molten sulfur. Sulfur is about 280 Fahrenheit, I believe, is the melting point. And it's much better to carry it as a molten rather than solids. The molten sulfur, when standing at the melting point and above, has a generation of gases, various kinds of sulfur gases, H2S and carbonyls and other things, some of whom are autocatalytic to start ignition. They have a ventilating system on. The ventilating system will take care of the vapors being generated normally. But the sulfur queen was off Florida in a very bad storm, and the last signal they got from them was, "We're in a violent storm," and something like that. They found a couple of lifeguard rings, for safety. That's all they ever heard from it. 33 men lost. And my analysis of that was that the bins were, the compartments were 20 feet tall, and if you take a 20-foot head of molten sulfur, It's a density of 1.8 or whatever it is. It is quite a bit of pressure. See, 40 foot of head is of water, when equivalent, would be like 18 pounds. Well, if you had an 18-pound pressure on some sulfur, it wouldn't give off this gas, but it would absorb it for a long time. And if you had violent storm and the rock of the ship caused the bottom of the bin right. to come to the top, it would belch, and the system would not be, the ventilating system would not be able to handle it. And and they must have had an explosion on the layer between the molten sulfur and the bottom of the deck, and it just blew it apart. But I made the analysis for them. Well, that's the kind of thing we did for the Coast Guard. We published various things, especially the list of, 200 chemicals and what their hazards were.
While we're talking about safety, we mentioned this at lunchtime, the East Ohio Gas Company.
Oh, yes.
Problem.
That was by not having dikes around the tanks. That's the system. Again, the system. Phillips people came to our meeting when I was asking about was explosion, what caused the explosion in the Bureau of Mines test. And he gave us a movie about this, and somebody asked him a question, and he said, well, you know, methane is normally a vapor, and so if it spills, it'll vaporize automatically. And I said, sir, we hoped no one would ever say those words together like that again after Cleveland, because it doesn't. But it was simply that the LNG got into both the front door of the laboratory and got down into the sewers and came up in these homes. They settled within the first 2 weeks of something like $8 million of claims. And it was the largest industrial disaster before Texas City that we'd ever had.
And I had, I remembered that, but I didn't realize that so many people in the laboratory were killed. That
90, I think it is, out of the 120 in the laboratory were killed. Including the man who was the head of the design team.